Hello and welcome to Promenade Culture Center. This is Culture Corner. We bring you the authentic stories from our creative communities. We are very pleased to have with us here today Asil Al-Yaqoub, a research-based artist. Welcome to Culture Corner, Asil.
Thank you for having me.
I'm so happy you're here. We rarely have an opportunity to speak to a full-time artist and a research-based and interdisciplinary artist as well. And having that in mind, I was hoping we can start with the very beginning of your path as an artist. Were you always an artist?
No, I was not. I think I was, I think it's easy to say that, oh, I really loved drawing when I was a kid, and I really loved pottery, and I loved studying art as an IGCSE or A-levels, and it was something that I felt was the thing that excited me the most in school. But then you could say, I love drawing. My brother drew more than I did. So I never felt like it was a reason to say that this is what I should pursue. But then again, I'm sure a lot of people would, I think it's like a very common thing to say in Kuwait is that it's not really a profession. There were no scholarships. We couldn't pursue it financially. So we had to think about that. And also the social constraints of what everyone, where you're going to go graduate and study and come back and everyone's going to call you an artist. Like it was looked down on as something that only the weird or the eccentric or those who were of a certain cultural...
Oh, the bravest among us.
Exactly, would do it. And I was smart in school, so that would have been a waste for my parents, especially my dad, who was like, well, why not go do architecture, which is sort of at the top of the hierarchy of art and design. I did. But honestly, it wasn't until I came back to Kuwait after I graduated that I think this is what really solidified my career in art. And it's a really, I mean, it's a really, it sounds juvenile and silly, but it just shows how a simple idea can turn into a really important social dialogue that can then be presented in a gallery. And I never imagined this project to get to that point. So in 2009, coming back to Kuwait, I felt like I was culturally dissociated. I didn't know a lot of people. I had been studying architecture for 7 years in London. And I felt like there was a barrier between me and sort of the rest of the social fabric in Kuwait. Not just that, I barely spoke Kuwaiti properly. So, you know, being that far away for so long, I even lost a lot of the language that I had acquired. So I took this teddy bear and I would document this bear, and I gave myself a year to do so until I found a job. And this bear would act as my social buffer, taking me from place to place and forcing me every day to look at new places in Kuwait, try to do what the locals do, whether it's like, oh, let's get a Starbucks, and Teddy is confused why there's so much caramel in a Starbucks cup. And these were all documented in a blog. And the blog was like the pre-Instagram era. Yes. And Kuwait was a huge blog, had a huge blog audience. Next thing I know, halfway through, I'm top 10 bloggers in Kuwait. Next thing I know, Teddy's being asked to talk in Pachakucha, Kuwait, and in Pachakucha, Dubai. Obviously, I would record and then present the bear, because the whole entire time I was also anonymous. So nobody knew who was behind the blog until the 365 photographs were sort of documented in a publication and exhibited at Sultan Gallery. And the audience that came out of Teddy's blog was so diverse that I ended up making so many new friends throughout the process, some of whom are still my closest friends today, from different parts of society that otherwise you would have been siloed from, through the interactions I had with Teddy. And it was that moment where I was like, I can do this. Like, I can take an idea, I can take these ideas and topics that grab my attention, and then I can investigate them, question them, and then present them to the audience to get a response, because this was where I realized my curiosity stemmed from. It's like, what is Kuwait? Why are we here? What does it do? And who are we doing it for?
Did you, at any point while you were in school, since you said you took art in school until the last level, did you do any project like this?
No,
sort of a research-based or an activist project, or
not at all. So my IGCSE, I actually got a D in my A levels. Like, I failed miserably. So I was like, I guess I'm not an artist, because it was drawing and painting.
How many stories like this from artists come, and it just meant nothing.
Exactly.
I wish these commissions, these people could see where people are today.
I know, right?
Yeah.
But I think it's because I didn't even grasp the idea of what conceptualizing was. Mm. And I'm actually really happy I did pursue architecture and sort of look into it due to its critical sort of undertakings of like buildings and how to create structures. And also the school I went to disputed what architecture was. It's not just a house. It's not just a building. Architecture could be very conceptual. It could also not exist as a physical thing. It could be a theory, a thought, a philosophy.
How did you manage to maintain the relationship with art while studying architecture? What good things came? You mentioned some, but did it also give you discipline? Because that's so necessary for an artist.
100%, exactly. The discipline, to become an artist, you have to be self-disciplined because there's no one over your head. There's no boss. There's no company that you're holding that you need to delegate work for and make sure that you go and do your 9-to-5. There's no sustainable income because it's sporadic, right? So you get a project here, get a project there. You need to hustle. And you need to also stay within the ethical and moral compass that you've established for yourself on, is this going to be detriment to my career or is this going to be beneficial to my career? Am I going to benefit also from learning from this or will it be something that will take me back or pigeonhole me into a certain category? So for me, architecture plays... You'll see it in my work as well. It's like the idea of creating installations, sculptures, drawings have very architectural elements from what I've learned. And there's a beauty to having the autonomy as an artist to say, this is how I want my exhibition to look like, 3D model it, and then apply it onto the physical space and be like, wow, like I just curated my own exhibition in the digital realm and it worked. And you can, and that way it's not that intuitive. And so it gives you multiple hats to wear and also gives you legitimacy when you say, well, I'm studying or I'm looking at nation building and I'm looking at architecture and I'm fascinated by all of these things and I have an architectural background too.
And that relationship with art while studying, you studied in London, right?
Yes.
Was it hard? Did you have to work on maintaining your interest in art? Did the school actually continuously expose you to art as well? Just figuring out how you maintain the interest and the training, so to speak, for art and culture.
Well, the school I went to initially was a very hands-on school. So my foundation year was going out and drawing buildings. Mm. We had to draft everything by hand. There was a model shop along with the wood making workshop. And then there was the casting studio. So, and then there was the sort of the idea of like, oh, there's so many different mediums I can use to express what I want to express in terms of architecture. So it's very similar to art in the sense of like, you need a medium to articulate yourself. But the difference between art and architecture is that art has no function. So in architecture, it needs to be functional. You need to inhabit the space. There needs to be space or it needs to be, or even if it's like on a sort of like a landscape sense, you know, how do you participate with this physically? Whereas art, you're not allowed to touch it. And if you are, it becomes interactive art or it falls into or sort of like interventionist art, but then it falls into a different category, right? So it's not meant to have a function, but it can. You're not limited to that. So I couldn't do art for a really long time because the philosophy I was being fed was that very much things have to have function. So graduating from that and then having to kind of remove that from me took a while. And that was the only way I managed to be able to do that was when I did my master's in fine arts.
And given that, and we'll talk about it later as well, how much of a local culture is a theme and a topic in your work, how much were you exposed to local art growing up or in school?
Not so much. I think museums. So I was in the New English School, so the Tariq Rajab Museum was around the corner. I think I went to it like 10 times as school trips. But honestly, I wasn't exposed that much. It was, again... the idea of like looking for it yourself. So I found art in the daily objects. I found art in the Archie comics. I found art in the things that I was collecting as a child. And I think rather than trying to be exposed to art and seeing what artists are doing and saying, wow, this is so inspiring, it was more about why do we have this object? And I became a hoarder and started collecting all of these things around me that made me question their existence. And so I think... when I look back, it was less about being an artist and more about feeding my curiosity at the end of the day. I'm obsessed about certain questions and things that are generated from the local narratives that I don't understand.
You delve into them then.
Yes.
Did you practice architecture as a proper architect?
Yes. Yeah,
so How was that experience?
So I went to Singapore first, which was really interesting because I think I was the only expat in the company. And they were all Singaporean or Malaysian and from the region, basically. And I was being used as a trope because, like, look, we have this Kuwaiti. Oh, my God, Kuwaiti. Wow. Like, it was so exotic for them. But I learned so much there within the 3 months that I had my internship. And then came back to Kuwait, worked with Aziz Al-Hmaili and Hamid Sultan for like a year as a junior architect. Was like, maybe it's Kuwait that's bothering me. Mm. Went and interned in Dubai and then realized that it's not, because I'm getting the same feeling here. And I think it's this—it's a part of me that I've come to terms with, and I think my whole family's come to terms with, is like, don't put me in a cage. I can't do the 9-to-5. And I know it's a very privileged thing to say, but it's like, well, how can I substitute this? In what way can I substitute this and how?
You have mentioned how you first discovered that you can do this, actually, that you can actually be an artist. And can you tell us more about that path, how it came to its first fruition?
So obviously the Teddy thing that I mentioned earlier, seeing the response, I think in contemporary art today, we keep forgetting that the artwork is not meant to be for the museum or for the collectors or for the institutions that they're made for, but rather to have a conversation with the audiences that you're making the work for. And I'm a true believer that art is a reflection of what we see on a daily basis. So even if an artist says, well, I want to just make beautiful paintings, that beauty comes from your own perception of the world. If you want to be a political artist and you want to reflect sort of these statements or subversive actions that are happening, and you want to make sort of like, you want to mobilize people towards something, then that's also art. So it's like a reflection in that sense. And I felt like, well, I need to go learn more about this. And I don't know, I guess I'm just a nerd, but I feel like I really wanted to go to school. And not just that, I was like, I'm done with the British system. Like, I'd really like to try the American system for once. Looked over some schools, really liked Pratt Institute, loved how, like, they're really into sort of the idea of socialist works, and applied. It was there that I actually found out that, you know, what art can be. So I was studying sculpture, but I could do a video. But the video would be read as sculpture. I was like, this is wild. Like, there's no rigor, there's no structure to what art can or cannot be. And it's questioned all the time, like at NFT today. You know, is that really art? It's not tangible, but is art supposed to be tangible? And so these conversations continue to happen. But for me, the thing that triggered me the most while I was studying, because of my curiosity and my big questions and this horrible thing that I've now detached from, which is like, oh, I want to be an international artist. And it's like, well, how am I going to talk to the world as a Kuwaiti? Who's going to care, you know? And what am I going to talk about? And if you see most artists that are trying to reach the Western audience, they will use tropes from our region to try to like reel them in. And I worry about the fetishization, romanticizing that happens when it's looked at from outside. So my thesis professor was like, well, you know, you're talking about really huge projects, topics like globalization, economics, the death of languages. I mean, you're researching things like, you want to research world affairs in a 2-year thesis. So he's like, tell me more about Kuwait. And this is where I got stumped. And I will honestly say, I realized I didn't know much. I went to an English school and then I went to London, and I realized then and there I'm a colonial product. I salute the Queen and when I did my brownies. I know more about Victorian, Edwardian and Georgian history than I do about my own history, about Arab history. And then I go to London and I'm surrounded by these museums that created their narratives through the theft of everyone's artifacts. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's where I was like, I think I've found my calling while maintaining my curiosity. And I'm going to use Kuwait as a case study.
And realizing this, does this mean as an artist we need to find our identity, or do we keep researching our identities?
I think we keep, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I'm still questioning this. It's been 10 years now and I've been looking at it, and it's like, whose identity are we talking about?
Yeah, exactly.
And which part of society do I, what's my micro community? Obviously, my micro community is my family. And then you have the semi-macro, which is your friends, your acquaintances, and the social circles that you interact with. And then you have the macro, and you realize that we live in very small existential bubbles around the country. We're siloed. We're not interacting. And when we do, the only places that you can do that are the public spaces. But even with that, you're restricted socially in terms of how you interact with each other. So then it becomes like, oh, I can't really look at the present. It was really stressing me out. And contextualizing myself within the present was really stressing me out. It's like, let me go back in time and focus on historical accounts and things that can actually help me understand what's going on right now, because I can't make sense of any of it.
As a culturologist, I frequently say that I don't believe in identities except the cultural identity, which is one for all. Mm. And I get questioned a lot what that means. That means that I can relate to any cultural product anywhere because it's part of our subconscious as dwellers of the earth. Mm. And I know how it sounds, but this is the only way for me to survive.
Yes.
What's going on in the world, the divisions, the fact what color of my skin tells others, or the color of my hair or my eyes or languages I speak, or because I have a mixed background, but I speak a certain language as my mother tongue, and so on and so forth. Mm. So we all express each other to each other differently. But there are also things that completely unite us, and we all respond to art.
Yes.
Now, I'm sure it sounds very difficult, very hefty when you say, I realize I'm a colonial product.
Yeah.
It gives me like, my skin crawls, you know. The fact that something large comes and we're kind of all exposed to that. We went to some international schools. I lived detached from whatever my background is and so on. So I can relate partly, obviously. Now, is it painful? What you're talking about, the fact that you have to go back and research. I know that some of your work really went into researching our art traditions, or did we inherit them?
Yes.
And I'd like for you, if you agree, to speak about that. And how painful is it for someone who keeps researching herself as an artist, as a human, as a person who belongs to a certain nation, carrying a certain name? How do you find your spot?
I liked what you said earlier. I won't dispute it, because I think what your take is quite humanist. So I wanted to just reference that and this idea of not categorizing, because categorizing is also there's an element to human control in that aspect as well. And we have to understand why are these discriminations come from and how these borders defined sort of this cultural identity that was invented post border delineations, and who made these borders to begin with. It wasn't like Kuwait decided, oh, this is where my periphery is, thank you very much. So is these some painful for me to say I'm a colonial product, because I think if anything, I want to say product, because it's almost like I was manufactured out of the system. Mm-hmm. But the system was applied after the British discovered humane imperialism. Mm-hmm. And we're like, oh, you know, there's things called colonization with the treaty, so if we sign, then you're a protectorate, you're not a colony. I dispute this, because all I say is that the only difference between this and that is that you've signed up to colonialism, because now they have jurisdiction over you. And they brought their British political subjects into your space. And they have their own jurisdictions versus your own jurisdictions. And basically, we have two states in one, which is a very controversial thing. Until you opt for liberation, and even after liberation, you never really truly reach this emancipation, in my opinion. Because then we appropriate the same institutions that once governed us. And we say, you know, this is how the British had their schools. Let's apply the same concept. This is how the British run the Kuwait oil towns, and this is how they produced oil. Let's follow suit. And so then that became traditionalized, right? And it's like, oh, but this has always been around. This has always been part of Kuwait. So I just want to question them. Obviously, I don't have a solution to them, but I'm just really worried about us taking these things very lightly and not noticing the consequences until way later, and being aware of the things that are around us that have manipulated sort of our identity, and to question what is or who has the authority to define that, and whether we should listen or not. So it's so for me, it's less painful. It's not painful. It's just like I want to be honest. Mm-hmm. I want to be truthful.
That pretty much sets you free.
Yes. And then it also It helps me to actually justify what I'm saying through my own lived experiences. It's like, I mean, one of the stories that I tell people and they're like always surprised by is like in the new English school, although it was a really great school, the predecessor to the new English school, I did Brownies. And in Brownies, we went to the boom and we stood on top of the ship. And we had to raise our three fingers and make a vow, like to promise to do our best, to do our duty to God, to serve my queen and help other countries, you know. And we had our sachets and we were like with our badges. And for a really long time, I thought the queen was all our queen as a child.
So this was part of school practices?
Yes. So this was like elementary.
Oh, very scary.
So I thought the queen was our queen and that the king served the queen of England. Our prince served her, you know. So these memories are what hold me down into this idea of like, we should not dismiss these little practices.
Yeah.
It's not cultural appropriation. You know, this is not cultural appropriation. It's assigned culture. And we're being given prescriptions to have these different type of cultural practices. And I just want to question that all the time. And so my work becomes that and the transition between reading history and then turning that into art and taking a question and presenting it visually is always that challenge that I love. And I think that's why it's hard to say I'm just an artist. I want to be a problem solver, but only through articulation. Not to say, by the way, this is what we should do because I'm not an expert in the field. Just like, how can I present this the best way? And sometimes it fails.
To question, I understand. But to question it constantly is somehow artist's role, the human role artists hold in the world. And also being part of that, what's it called, like a positive social change or any social change is I think where artists contribute the most. You have so many significant, interesting and complex exhibitions, and we don't have that much time, I think, to cover them all. But would be really lovely to talk about them, to talk about the topics and how you approach them. How much time does the research take you? Are you ever satisfied with the end of the research? Or do you feel, okay, if I don't now construct an exhibition, it's not happening? Do you require help? Do you work on your own? I'm really, really interested in how you form an exhibition and the topics you cover. And you can really choose whatever you like to share with us.
Okay.
There's plenty.
So I'll go with something a bit easy to explain, right? Mm-hmm. So I'll go with Culture Fair, which was a project that I did as part of my thesis. But
this was 2018, yes. I think. Yes. Okay.
Yes. I was, when looking at Kuwait, you know, I want to understand Kuwait through its visual culture. And propaganda is a really huge aspect of that. And during the golden era, which was Kuwait's prime time, sort of like throttling through modernization, leading and paving the way for the region in terms of like the oil boom and all of that. But then I was like feeling there's a word that I use a lot, which is Sehnsucht, which is a German word for feeling nostalgic or a longing for a past that you do not exist in or never experienced. So I was like, this is horrible. As I'm looking at all these times, like the opening of Kuwait University, Traffic Day, Mother's Day, and just these beautiful illustrations on the stamps of an artist I couldn't even find. I didn't even know who made these stamps. And I kept looking, but it had the same visual culture, so precise. It was being disseminated all over the world. It was an ad campaign for Kuwait, basically. But then I was like, but look at us now. And sort of comparing that golden era to today, I realized that this utopic vision was not achievable. And so I began dissecting these stamps, like with a scalpel and a magnifying dome, cutting out these layers from them, which I had pre-designed digitally so that I don't mess up any of them. Because there's some that if I cut it, it's gone. It's like this idea of also letting go of the past, and it became very therapeutic. It's like, so what if it's a rare stamp?
Yeah.
This time is non-existent. And I think the present is more important. Let's focus on that and sort of creating new narratives out of that reflected using the old stamps, current day stamps. But then, you know, researching in general, it used to stress me out a lot. And I think I have a lot of my white hairs because of this. It's like reading and then like getting into really deep philosophical, existential questions, and then disputes on identity politics. And I'm like, I need to go to school again now, you know, to really understand what the hell's going on.
It's a never-ending process.
Never-ending. But I learned the more you know, the less you know. So I relaxed a bit and I was like, Asil, you're an artist, you know? You're not going to be the person who's going to save the world or anything, or Kuwait or anything like that. It's just like, how do you want to approach things? And I was like, I found the method that gives me this drive, which is, guys, did you know? Mm-hmm. Look what I found. Did you know? Did anyone know? And when I realized that nobody knew, then I'm like, here's an idea. I need to make everybody know about this.
I realized talking to different guests, there are so many things to learn about the past. Of course, I don't know a lot. I've been here for only or so far 9 years. But I've had people call and tell me, oh, we've listened to this podcast. And then now there are 3 buildings I need to visit. And there, so this abundance of things that have happened and haven't been researched enough, documented enough, somehow leave me with a thought that hopefully more people will have the approach to art the way you have it. A lot is lost about Kuwait in the what is a daily offering of Kuwait, it feels. So I had a cousin, I think I mentioned this already in one of the shows, come from London and visit me. And she is art historian by education. She doesn't do that anymore. She has run away from art. But this was her approach. She said, I will research what I want to see in Kuwait when I come. And then she called me and said, first, everywhere, it's just the malls. You know, when you start looking into these pages and so on. So there's so much to look into in the past. And I think one of the things that really are sort of an obstacle is we don't know where to look. Yeah. Now, for me, obviously, language is a constraint and is an obstacle. But where are these places to look, you know? How do you do your research?
So obviously,
depending on the topic,
depending
obviously.
On, I think depending on all topics, I always buy books. So I always find books by books. My biggest source actually are antique dealers on Instagram. Mm. I have like 10 really good older men who have been hoarding for ages, selling all the time on their Instagram. And we've talked so many times and I've explained my practice to them so many times that they now message me or DM me to say, I think this is up your alley. So they'd be like, I just found this or I bought this and would you be interested in this? And I'd be like, yes, you know, they're not cheap and they know they make a lot of money out of them because the past is so rare. So it's like, I'm really investing in these things. And so my studio actually is not my art. My studio is just the things I've collected over the years. The more precious, if it's precious, it's at home. And if it's something that I can share with people who come visit, it's like, I'd rather not show you my work. I'd rather show you what I found. And it's the books, like Dixon's Accounts of Kuwait, like a letter opener made by Tanagra in Kuwait in 1981.
Rare finds.
Rare finds that is like, oh, this is a historical marker, you know, because it was 81. The Kuwait Towers had just finished. And so the letter opener had that, you know.
Occasionally, I find very interesting books, either in English or bilingual, and we buy them for our future little library we are planning here. And you read the publisher's name, and these are all these institutions or institutes that don't exist anymore. So it's, where are the books?
Exactly.
You know, where are these things? Someone
must have
them. A lot are
banned, by the way. A lot are banned in terms of Kuwait history. But in terms of where you go and what to do, like, I find local guides to be the best. Mm. So if you have an interest in anything, like, oh, you know, I am interested in art history, talk, like, I'm just saying this to the podcast so that if anyone who listens to it wants to come to Kuwait, if you're interested in the arts, then contact an artist. If you're interested in architecture, contact an architect. We'll know where these things are. They're not promoted on TripAdvisor because we don't have tourism here.
Of course.
Tourism is to highlight certain things that are happening and to engage with the local community to see what the locals are doing as well. It's like, not just 5-star hotels, but are there other hotels run by, you know, like boutique hotels or anything like that you can stay in that are alternatives to these things that you are generalizing?
I was wondering about the work you did for the exhibition for La Biennale di Venezia.
Putting 4 to 5 to 6 people that never worked together in their lives into a group or a collective is a huge risk. So, but our commitment was that, you know what, let's look at our backgrounds, let's look at our disciplines. How can we create a project out of all of our interests together and see what are the topics that address the brief that is assigned. So with architecture, the brief is always like, you know, unlike art, which is, you know, you can say, oh, you know, I want you to do work about, you know, the hidden elements of the sand. Mm. And then you show the sky. It can be disputed, you know, but with architecture, it's like, no, you need to address the brief. So the markers that were assigned in that brief by Hashim Sarkis was that it's, you know, the 30th anniversary. For us, that was like, we linked it to the Gulf War. We linked the multiple milestones that happened in Kuwait from the Gulf War to the border, to the Battle of Jahra in 1920. So all of these things and its impact on Kuwait's hinterland. So what is the desert? A desert is also a colonial word, which is arid, barren, wasteland, empty. Nothing's in it. So me, Yusuf, Safiya, and Asail were like, we want to dispute that. But we also want to show this idea of the top-down sort of analysis of Kuwait, whether it was built from the sky through its first master plan, whether it was navigated through GPS through the first space wars, which was the Gulf War, and that's when GPS was introduced, and whether the continuation of this top-down perspective will impact the future settlements that are shoring Iraq and Saudi Arabia, such as Khairan City or Mutla City. So that's how we came to the fruition of the project. And also looking again at the past, present, and then inviting contributors to contemplate future projections or where they think these things can be or should be going.
I'd like to mention another exhibition. I'm very fascinated by the complexity of your approach at the graduation ceremony. Was this the last one, actually?
Yes.
Well, so far, the one in Kuwait.
In Kuwait, yes.
Yes, in Kuwait. And that was an interesting topic. That's not a common topic in Kuwait, is it, the military? Or do you...
I mean, from a woman perspective?
Yes. Yeah. For instance, one of the perspectives, yes.
So it was in 2015.
I thought more of a, like, artists don't really approach this as, you know, it's not an easy, pretty topic.
No. But also the Kuwait's military isn't like the American military. It's almost a facade because we really can't defend ourselves. I mean, it's important. It's a homeosocial institution that is very important in all countries, whether they're weak or strong.
But women are not members of the military.
Only
Kuwait,
in administration.
No? Okay.
Yeah. So there was a whole thing about women joining the military, but they would have to be wearing the hijab and they wouldn't be...
That was
be...
a couple of years ago, was it?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. But they're not allowed to learn how to shoot a gun, for example. So it's like, what's the point? But for me, it was the WhatsApp video that I saw of a military demonstration in Saudi Arabia, and it was in preparation for the Hajj pilgrimage, ahead of the Hajj pilgrimage. And it was a display of their prowess, sort of, you know, but it was like very theatrical with like fireworks and, you know, selfie background, like looking at the phone and shooting backwards. So it was like very, like a lot of stunts. Mm-hmm. It was stunt based. So I by the end of the video, I clapped, you know, on YouTube. I was like, wow, you know, it felt very entertaining, you know, but also it's like, wow, Saudi has like leveled up, you know. I was like, I wonder what Kuwait's like. And that's when I went into the wormhole, and the wormhole lasted 5 years. Okay. Because it was like, well, I don't know anything about the military, so I had to go learn about the military industrial complex, and I had to learn about the history of demonstrations. And then I read a book called The Military Spectacle, which talked about how the British military throughout the end of their sort of imperial rule or empire were more about display and presentation than they were about like being an aggressive force, and how Kuwait appropriated a lot of these things throughout its history. And linked it to the Transjordanian army, basically, which is where a lot of the Arab inspiration comes from.
How was the feedback of general public to your exhibition?
Well, I think because my Instagram was just military stories over. People were like, I met actually soldiers and people in the military who were like, why are you doing this? Who are you? And then I'd be like, can you talk? Like, I'd love to know more, you know? Why do you do this? Why does this happen? Do you know what the history of this is? And then I realized a lot of the genealogy of Kuwait's military was lost, and that became my prime focus. And the people's response to that was very much like, but can you tell us what are we learning from this? And then when the exhibition happened, they were like, oh my God, we are sort of still colonized to some extent, or we've forgotten our history of colonization. Because this is my point. It's like I'm trying to prove that a lot of people wrong when they say we weren't colonized. We were a protectorate. And I'm trying to really show them, like, do you see? It's in the little things sometimes. It's not in the big things. For example, the red and white chmak or headscarf, that was, in like, according to him, invented by a British lieutenant general who was training the Transjordanian army in Jordan, designed this for them so that he can differentiate them from the Palestinian and northern sort of Shami, Iraq, Syrian colors, and create their own new national identity as Jordan, because the British were very heavy-handed in Jordan. And then that, I have a video of a black and white Sheikh Salim al-Sabah, not Sheikh Salim, sorry, Sheikh Abdullah Salim al-Sabah, going to the military parade in Jordan to witness it firsthand, and was so amazed by it that he came back and dressed the National Guard in the red and white shmak and the colonial sort of like pants and coat. So when people saw that, they would be like, no way, you know, like that's impossible.
A lot of things we just take for granted.
Yeah.
That it's been there forever, or that it's simply part of something that's
our tradition.
Or yes, we have come up with it.
Yeah, and we haven't. So
while you're talking about it, I think later on I have to share with you. She lives in France. She's Serbian by origin. She's a documentary filmmaker, and she has spent years. When you said 5 years, you've spent on this. Years and years and years on researching materials related to Algerian war. Because the person who joined them and documented the war for liberation was Yugoslav. At the time. Because Yugoslavia was part of a non-aligned movement. And then it would send its documentarists and filmmakers to various African or Asian countries to help them document their liberations. And then a lot of these people, it was the time, I guess, would kind of feel they need to join them. Mm. And they would stay with them. And then she was researching the military, and she has so many amazing, just amazing materials.
I'd love to see her stuff.
And she says that if you enter some of these archives, your life can be spent there. And there are so many on so many countries which were trying to do the same thing, trying to figure out where do they start. Where does the colonial force end? Mm-hmm. How much is it interwoven? And one of the things that I've learned, for instance, that always rings with me is when France left Algeria, finally, 90% or more of people were illiterate. Mm. So
the Dark Ages.
That's with the cause. You know why you're leaving people. You know, not being able to read or write or use there. So this is something that's why I wanted to ask you about the topic, because the topic is so much more than just military.
Yeah.
It speaks so much about the country itself, the people.
It's not just through the dissemination of the British sort of military spectacle onto the Kuwaitis and teaching them how to walk and how to, you know, because they lose their bodies, right? They become part of a disciplinary institution. And they are no longer in control of what they do and what they say and how they do it. And this is the cost of sort of appropriating these types of techniques. Like, why aren't we appropriating sort of the Arabian tribal way of, you know, battle? Or why don't we look at the Islamic way in which Islam spread through civilization, through Khalid ibn Walid, or, you know, the strategies of the military during that time? Why are we fixated on this new contemporary form just because the World War II happened and we're all silenced by it? That the idea of it being like, this is what war looks like now, doesn't have to mean that we have to appropriate. So if we do that on that scale, then don't doubt that we aren't doing it on our everyday lives, even the way we're drinking our tea or what tea we're drinking. And there's one thing to enjoy the beauty of everything. Yeah. It's another thing to practice, you know, tea time and scones as part of like a family tradition. It's an appropriated family tradition that you learned from the British when they were there, and it became sort of a part of you and your narrative. But be aware, that's all I'm saying. I'm not saying change your lifestyle.
No, diversity is our strength, but not necessarily, but only if we see it as such. Were you stereotyped while you were abroad?
While I was abroad?
Yes. How much were you like an exotic? You did mention some of it, like an exotic, appearance to some people, or were you able to fully just practice art the way you wanted?
So when I graduated, and I mean, obviously when I'd make work in school, there was always this fascination. Can you tell us more about Kuwait? Can you tell us more about Kuwait? So no one really knows much, obviously, because we're not in the news or there's not much happening. Mm. So when I went and tried to, I was like, let me be an artist in London for a year and a half and see where that goes. I was instantly labeled as a female Arab artist in diaspora. And I hated the diaspora part because it was a choice for me to be here. I'm not leaving my country to live abroad because I have to.
Yeah, you didn't immigrate, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm here temporarily, I feel, unless things change. And then I feel like this is where my life is going to be. But I've been here for 6 months and I'm already in diaspora. So it's these little tiny little labels that I feel like it's a very, like, you kind of washes over the essence, individual essence of the artist to create like a collective sort of definition of the things that they want to reuse in the cultural landscape. Coming back here, though, I was called the chicken nugget, so... That's also another thing.
So you don't belong, really. Wherever you are, somehow you have to be, not you per se, yeah, but like labeled.
Everyone doesn't belong.
Yeah.
I feel. Yeah. This idea of belonging and thinking that you belong. And this is why I really like what you said earlier. It's like we need to transcend these things. And I don't want to be so esoteric, but it's the only way for us to understand what identity is. Because if we say that this is the Kuwait's national identity, take it or leave it, it's from whose perspective are
exactly,
we talking
yeah,
about?
Yeah. And it's evident that it's one group now might be a different group later on.
Yeah.
And I think the people either really don't know or they pretend they're not aware of this polarization in a way. And then a group thinking they overlap the other group or the third group or whoever is where the real problem lies. I am interested in how you feel about Kuwait artistic scene. I don't like using these terms, but it's good to know what you feel is good and what you feel is missing. Because I am sure you would want the artistic scene to thrive in terms of people being able to practice art, express art, and cultural consumption to rise.
Yeah, I mean... It was good that this past year or 2 years or since after COVID that I had the opportunity to showcase my work around the region, whether it's Qatar, Emirates or Saudi, and to work with these institutions, as well as the institutions like the Venice Biennale and how they function as an institution. And then I came to a realization that even in Saudi, like most of the stuff there is Ministry of Culture. So that's a state-run apparatus. If it's in the Emirates, then it's or Qatar, it's either through VCU, Northwestern University, NYU, Abu Dhabi, which are American institutions, or it's through the state-led institutions as well.
It's very top-down with the Qatari specifically.
Yes. So looking at that and experiencing that, I'm like, you know what? Actually, I wish we had state-led institutions that were competent and that would be allowing us to sort of like commission artists to create public sculptures for Kuwait, export these artists. You know, this is really, really important. But at the same time, I'm like, but then you would have to accept the fact that you are no longer autonomous and that you serve the state and the state's agenda through your art. Because this region will not accept the idea of us being so liberal that we will let the artists do whatever they want and commission whatever they want. It has to be within the standards and the boundaries of what the state wants the narrative to be. So the grassroots for me, I think after COVID, this has been wonderful. And I feel like everyone's just coming together again and being like, you know, we were isolated for so long. We need to change things here. And we need to change things on the cultural landscape, not just the art scene, but like let's unite somehow. And I felt like this is the only place where you have the independence to express yourself and to experiment and to explore. And then also define yourself, because it's been 10 years. I'm still trying to define what kind of artist I am. I was a multidisciplinary artist, then I became a visual artist, then I became a research-based artist. And then someone was like, you're actually quite interdisciplinary. You jump from field to field. You should label yourself that. And I'm like, there's so many labels. But it's a process, right? And it keeps changing because our identity also keeps changing.
True. I think the... what would be useful is having some sort of a framework of policies for culture to grow. for that, you need obviously certain things in place in terms of government. But grassroots approach has always had my heart. I mean, that's the best way. And also, that's where the content comes from. Content shouldn't come from other places. It should come from artists themselves. There are so many things I'd like to ask. So I'm trying to figure out the most important things. Would you share something with us, please, about Safat Studios? Because that's a platform for voices to join.
I hope so. Well, it was because I was looking for a space. And it was the first space I had here in Kuwait was like very close to my family because they had a floor. So I took one of their rooms because, you know, like, rent's so expensive. And then I was like, but I don't feel like I'm inspired here. They're doing their own businesses and whatever. And I'm not, why is an artist in the same floor in this pristine office with them? It doesn't make sense. Then looking for places, I couldn't find any. And the opportunity arose where I could curate tenants. And so it was like artist real estate almost, where I was like, please, please, just like give me this floor and I will take these spaces and just curate the tenants forever and ever and create this place where I will have my studio there. I love it there. And I will ensure that there is the right people at all times, even when people leave and come back. It's a journey to create this introduction of like, hi guys, there's this new tenant who's here. This is their background. And I let it be. Like I tried in the beginning to do some programs and film screenings and stuff. And I was like, I don't have time for this. And we're talking about it earlier. It's like, it's volunteer work again, which I can get to later in my life when I'm like semi-retired. But right now, this is my peak of energy. I need to keep going. And I've just noticed that there's collaborations that are happening now behind my back. This person's 3D printing for this person. This person's photographing and filmmaking for that person. And there's like, can I use the gallery space to do like a test of my upcoming exhibition? I just want to see how everything looks like. And I'm like, wow, this is really
self-generating. Yeah, exactly how you were hoping for.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's great.
In your work, your current work, and I'd like, as I know there's an exhibition coming up and I'd like to talk about that. But I also like you to have a little bit of a, if you can share your opinion and your thoughts on the, let's say the role of the artist in helping the community fix itself in a way. Not necessarily to, because the artist's role is always seen as something that's not that crucial, but we know differently. And in all of these public narratives, public disputes, talking about where we belong, what is this polarized, deeply polarized world currently taking us to? What sides should we take? What is the role of the artist really? Is it just to kind of speak his or her truth? Is it to help the social processes? Is it to just kind of be present and document?
I think some or all of the above, right? So the documentation is really important, right? So the works function as sort of something to reflect back on and compare to or analyze through the artist's lens on what was happening at the time. Why was Isil doing military works in 2024, for example? And questioning that sort of... Was it 24? 22?
Yeah, sorry. I've researched this.
So much has happened.
Yeah.
So
2 years already since
two
the,
years, yeah.
the exhibition.
Crazy.
Yeah.
I think it's only because the upcoming exhibition is confusing my dates.
Yeah.
Why was I looking at that? Mm. And then like seeing what were other artworks that were being done at the time as well. And wow, there was a whole wave of artists that were really focused on the past and this idea of nostalgia and memory and narratives. Why? What was going on at the time? And I think this is important. But then, again, we're not supposed to solve problems. We're not supposed to stitch the fabric of the society together and sort of resolve anything. It may work over time as through the grassroots that we were talking about. But for me, I can't speak on other artists, but like for me, the most effective way I felt as an artist that I'm contributing back was not through the exhibitions themselves or the work that's generated from them, because that's always within the context of the white cube. And there's like an air about these events, right? The exhibition.
Yeah.
And then there's also the artist needs to be present a lot of the times to explain the work. But for me, it was the workshopping. So, workshop with artists or talk or... And it's this idea of sharing process and sharing information and doing these workshops with people who weren't artists that then realize, wow, art is a tool also to try to understand things, because it can be really ominous and overbearing to say, I don't know the answer to this question, but I've been thinking about it a lot. And one way to figure it out is to start collaging, it's to start photographing, it's to start, and then giving these tools to society to sort of reflect upon their own existential issues.
How about the new exhibition you're preparing?
So
it's abroad.
It's my first international solo show, and I'm very happy to be showing at this place specifically, because my work tends to read very much sort of like academic research with footnotes and stuff. Like, I've written, even my catalog has footnotes, so I can be very rigorous with that I really get excited when I'm shown in academic institutions. So the exhibition is called A View from Above. It's curated by Anka Ryuju, and it's going to be at the Bildmuseet Museum in Umeå in Sweden. That's part of Umeå University, which has an art school, art faculty, and architecture faculty. So it's basically 10 years, 2014 to 2024, retrospective of my work. So it's really intimidating to have your first solo show be a retrospective, like a mini retrospective. I don't feel I'm ready there.
Yes, I understand.
I'm not established, you know, but she found it really important to bridge the art and the architecture through my concepts of nation building, through the idea of military as theater, military as architecture, and even the postage stamps and the visual aspect of it in terms of like the assembly and deassembly sort of process in my work that I use often.
What other things are in plans that you're... Is there anything you're preparing for Kuwait? Do you hold talks? Do you... organize workshops? Where can we find you these days?
Next week, actually, on Friday, I don't know when this is coming up, but on Friday, I'll be giving another talk at Gallery Bawa. A lot of people wanted to attend for the last one, but the capacity was quite small. It's like it's his space, and it's not going to fit that many people. So I will be doing that again. The next talks, I think I will be exhibiting the Space Words project, the one we did for the Venice Biennale. We'll be exhibiting two works at NYU Abu Dhabi. There's going to be a huge quintennale, which is like a 5-year of Gulf artists or arts works about the Gulf.
You get to cooperate with regional artists.
Do I get to...
Or to cooperate or keep ties or exchange, share skills? How does it look regionally? We've spoken locally. Is there a regional collaboration that actually exists and carries some power?
I think so, yeah. I think so. I think the most successful exhibitions or collaborations are the ones where you bring these different artists together from the Gulf, for example, and see what everyone was doing. Like, the concept's interesting. Like, 5 years, what has been happening? The work has to be within the past 5 years. So these artists from Saudi, from the Emirates, from Oman, from all over, but not just that, Indian artists that live in the Gulf, Palestinians, Syrians, all participating in the cultural landscape here. What are they producing and why are they producing it? And how will this be curated? So then I'm excited for this because we get to see that in action. We get to see this huge group biennale, quintennale thing for what it is. And then I think that will also bridge ties. And I think the sleeping giant that is Saudi Arabia is an interesting, for the past 5 years, is an interesting place and a mobilizer. It's creating very healthy competition. So the Emirates are no longer the sort of the thing that we look for. Qatar tried for a bit and we're like, maybe, but it failed.
They have a different approach. Yeah, yes. That didn't work really.
But then you have now Saudi it's basically on speed. It's just going crazy. And not just in Riyadh, but in Jeddah. And now it's going to Hayl and, you know, the East Coast. And we're all waiting to some extent.
It's so big trickle. And it must still hide so many creatives out there.
Yes.
Yeah. Are you preparing some new interesting topics that you're researching? You don't have to disclose, I'm just kind of hopeful you are.
I am. I've been thinking about it for a while and I got sidetracked by a lot of projects, but I don't know where it's going to go because this is how my research starts. Mm. So speaking of identity, like I found a book about my great-great-grandfather. His name was Talib al-Naqib and he was basically in Basra. And I realized this sort of also pushes the colonial project in me, which is like, oh, wow, because his story is so fascinating. He basically sort of disputed the Turkish sort of them as being the colonizers of Basra, and then the British came and imposed King Faisal I, and he was basically exiled to Bombay, came back, then exiled again for good to Ceylon or Sri Lanka because of how anti-imperialist he was. And I'm just reading more about that, and I've been talking to academics around the world who I would be like, you know, I read this book and I really want to know more for your perspective. And they're like, can we just Zoom and talk about this guy that is your great-great-grandfather? I don't know where it's going to go, because I hate including the personal in the...
I understand.
So I want to see where is this going, and I don't want to make it like a show about my great-great-grandfather.
At the same time, you have the obligation to share this with the world.
Yes,
You know, it's such a fascinating story.
But figuring it out and how, and linking it to now. Yeah, and sort
and of where are the boundaries that you're comfortable with.
Yes. Mm. And also just to... This has taken me to a time marker outside of Kuwait now. So the relationship of Basra to Kuwait at the time, and then his relationship with Sheikh Mubarak and Sheikh Hazal at the time. And there was this triangle between sort of Iran, Kuwait, Iraq. And that was interesting, but now completely dislodged and dismembered by the British. So that's sort of where I'm heading for. But again, very, very premature.
I am so happy we've shared so much today, and our time pretty much flew. Thank you so much for coming, having some time off for Culture Corner, for sharing these beautiful stories with us and your plans. And we're very, very much hoping we'll see you soon again.
I hope so too. It was lovely. Thank you so much, Sanya.
Thank you, Asil.